Chapter 6. Hijacked. The Division of Learning in Society. They wondered why the fruit had been forbidden. It taught them nothing new. They hid their pride, but did not listen much when they were chidden. They knew exactly what to do outside. W. H. Auden, Sonnets from China, 1. 1. The Google Declarations. On December 4th, 1492, Columbus escaped the onshore winds that had prevented his departure from the island that we now call Cuba. Within a day, he dropped anchor off the coast of a larger island known to its people as Quisqueya or Bohio, setting into motion what the historians call the conquest pattern. It's a design that unfolds in three phases. The invention of legalistic measures to provide the invasion with a gloss of justification, a declaration of territorial claims, and the founding of a town to legitimate and institutionalize the conquest. The sailors could not have imagined that their actions that day would write the first draft of a pattern whose muscle and genius would echo across space and time to a digital 21st century. On Bohio, Columbus finally found a thriving material culture worthy of his dreams and the appetites of the Spanish monarchs. He saw gold, elaborate stone and woodwork, ceremonial spaces, stone-lined ball courts, stone collars, pendants, and stylized statues, richly carved wooden thrones, elaborate personal jewelry. Convinced that the island was his best find so far, with the most promising environment and the most ingenious inhabitants, he declared to Queen Isabella, "It only remains to establish a Spanish presence and order them to perform your will. For they are yours to command and make them work, sow seed, and do whatever else is necessary and build a town, and teach them to wear clothes and adopt our customs." According to the philosopher of language, John Searle, a declaration is a particular way of speaking and acting that establishes facts out of thin air, creating a new reality where there was nothing. Here is how it works. Sometimes we speak to simply describe the world. You have brown eyes. Or to change it. Shut the door. A declaration combines both. Asserting a new reality by describing the world as if a desired change were already true. All humans are created equal. They are yours to command. As Searle writes, we make something the case by representing it as being the case. Not every declaration is a spoken statement. Sometimes we just describe, refer to, talk about, think about, or even act in relation to a situation in ways that create a reality by representing that reality as created. For example, let's say the waiter brings my friend and me two identical bowls of soup, placing one bowl in front of each of us. Without saying anything, he has declared that the bowls are not the same. One bowl is my friend's, and the other bowl is mine. We strengthen the facts of his declaration when I take soup only from my bowl, and my friend takes soup from his. When his bowl is empty, my friend is still hungry, and he asks permission to take a spoonful of soup from the bowl in front of me, further establishing the fact that it is my bowl of soup. In this way, declarations rise or fall on the strength of others' acceptance of the new facts. As Searle concludes, all of institutional reality, and therefore all of human civilization, is created by declarations. Declarations are inherently invasive because they impose new facts on the social world while their declarers devise ways to get others to agree to those facts. Columbus's declaration reflects this conquest pattern, as historian Matthew Restall writes. 16th-century Spaniards consistently presented their deeds and those of their compatriots in terms that prematurely anticipated the completion of conquest campaigns and imbued conquest chronicles with an air of inevitability. The phrase Spanish conquest and all it implies has come down through history, Because the Spaniards were so concerned to depict their endeavors as conquests and pacifications, as contracts fulfilled, as providential intention, as fait accompli. The Spanish conquerors and their monarchs were eager to justify their invasion as one way to induce agreement, especially among their European audience. They developed measures intended to impart a legalistic veneer by citing and following approved precedents. To this end, the soldiers were tasked with reading the monarchical edict of 1513, known as the Requerimiento, to indigenous villagers before attacking them. The edict declared that the authority of God, the Pope, and the King was embodied in the conquistadors, and then declared the native peoples as vassals subordinate to that authority. You Cassocks and Indians of this continent, we declare, or be it known to you all, that there is but one God, one hope, and one King of Castile, who is lord of these countries. Appear forth without delay, and take the oath of allegiance to the Spanish king as his vassals. The edict went on to enumerate the sufferings that would befall the villagers if they failed to comply. In this world-shattering confrontation with the unprecedented, the native people were summoned, advised, and forewarned in a language they could not fathom to surrender without resistance in recognition of authorities they could not conceive. The exercise was so cynical and cruel that the approaching invaders often dispatched their obligation by mumbling the edict's long paragraphs into their beards in the dead of night, as they hid among thick vegetation waiting to pounce. Once the Europeans had discharged their duty to inform, the way was clear for pillage and enslavement. The friar Bartolomé de las Casas, whose account bears witness to this history of Spanish atrocities, wrote that the requerimiento promised the native people fair treatment upon surrender, but also spelled out the consequences of defiance. Every act of indigenous resistance was framed as revolt, thereby legitimizing brutal retaliation that exceeded military norms, including grotesque torture, the burning of whole villages in the dark of night, and hanging women in public view. I will do to you all the evil and damages that a lord may do to vassals who do not obey or receive him. And I solemnly declare that the deaths and damages received from such will be your fault, and not that of His Majesty, nor mine, nor of the gentlemen who came with me. Conquest by declaration should sound familiar because the facts of surveillance capitalism have been carried into the world on the strength of 6 critical declarations pulled from thin air when Google first asserted them. That the facts they proclaimed have been allowed to stand is evident in the dispossession strategies of Verizon and other new entrants to the surveillance capitalist firmament. In the rapture of the young firm's achievements, Google's founders, fans and adoring press passed over in silence the startling vision of invasion and conquest concealed in these assertions. The 6 declarations laid the foundation for the wider project of surveillance capitalism and its original sin of dispossession. They must be defended at any cost because each declaration builds on the one before it. If one falls, they all fall. We claim human experience as raw material free for the taking. On the basis of this claim, we can ignore considerations of individuals' rights, interests, awareness, or comprehension. On the basis of our claim, we assert the right to take an individual's experience for translation into behavioral data. Our right to take, based on our claim of free raw material, confers the right to own the behavioral data derived from human experience. Our rights to take and to own confer the right to know what the data disclose. Our rights to take, to own, and to know confer the right to decide how we use our knowledge. Our rights to take, to own, to know, and to decide confer our rights to the conditions that preserve our rights to take, to own, to know, and to decide. Thus, the age of surveillance capitalism was inaugurated with 6 declarations that defined it as an age of conquest. Surveillance capitalism succeeded by way of aggressive declaration, and its success stands as a powerful illustration of the invasive character of declarative words and deeds, which aim to conquer by imposing a new reality. These 21st century invaders do not ask permission. They forge ahead, papering the scorched earth with faux legitimation practices. Instead of cynically conveyed monarchical edicts, they offer cynically conveyed terms of service agreements whose stipulations are just as obscured and incomprehensible. They build their fortifications, fiercely defending their claimed territories, while gathering strength for the next incursion. Eventually, they build their towns in intricate ecosystems of commerce, politics, and culture that declare the legitimacy and inevitability of all that they have accomplished. Eric Schmidt asked for trust, but Google's declarations ensured that it did not require our trust to succeed. Its declarative victories have been the means through which it amassed world-historic concentrations of knowledge and power. These are the bulwarks that enable its continued progress. Schmidt has occasionally revealed something like this point. When describing modern technology platforms, he writes that almost nothing, short of a biological virus, can scale as quickly, efficiently, or aggressively as these technology platforms. And this makes the people who build, control, and use them powerful too. On the strength of its unprecedented concentrations of knowledge and power, surveillance capitalism achieves dominance over the division of learning in society, the axial principle of social order in an information civilization. This development is all the more dangerous because it is unprecedented. It cannot be reduced to known harms, and therefore does not easily yield to known forms of combat. What is this new principle of social order, and how do surveillance capitalists take command of it? These are the questions that we pursue in the sections that follow. The answers help us reflect on what we have learned and prepare for what lies ahead. 2. Who knows? This book began by recalling an urgent question posed to me by a young pulp mill manager in a small southern town. Are we all going to be working for a smart machine, or will we have smart people around the machine? In the years that followed that rainy evening, I closely observed the digitalization of work in the pulp mill. As I described it in the Age of the Smart Machine, the shift to information technology transformed the mill into an electronic text that became the primary focus of every worker's attention. Instead of the hands-on tasks associated with raw materials and equipment, doing a good job came to mean monitoring data on screens and mastering the skills to understand, learn from, and act through the medium of this electronic text. What seems ordinary today was extraordinary then. These obvious changes, I argued, signaled a deep and significant transformation. The ordering principle of the workplace had shifted from a division of labor to a division of learning. I wrote about the many women and men who surprised themselves and their managers as they conquered new intellectual skills and learned to thrive in the information-rich environment. But I also documented the bitter conflicts that attended those achievements, summarized as dilemmas of knowledge, authority, and power. Any consideration of the division of learning must resolve these dilemmas expressed in three essential questions. The first question is, who knows? This is a question about the distribution of knowledge and whether one is included or excluded from the opportunity to learn. The second question is, who decides? This is a question about authority. Which people, institutions, or processes determine who is included in learning, what they are able to learn, and how they are able to act on their knowledge? What is the legitimate basis of that authority? The third question is, who decides who decides? This is a question about power. What is the source of power that undergirds the authority to share or withhold knowledge? The young manager would ultimately find his answers, but they were not what either of us had hoped for. Even as the pulp mill workers struggled and often triumphed, Hayek's worldview was taking hold at the highest policy levels, and Jensen's operational disciplines were finding an eager welcome on Wall Street, which quickly learned to impose them on every public company. The result was a cost-down business model oriented to its Wall Street audience, which insisted on automating and exporting jobs rather than investing in the digital skills and capabilities of the U.S. worker. The answer to the question, who knows, was that the machine knows, along with an elite cadre able to wield the analytic tools to troubleshoot and extract value from information. The answer to who decides was a narrow market form and its business models that decide. Finally, in the absence of a meaningful double movement, the answer to who decides defaults entirely to financial capital bound to the disciplines of shareholder value maximization. It is not surprising that nearly 40 years later, a Brookings Institution report laments that millions of U.S. workers are shut out of decent middle-skill opportunities in the face of rapid digitalization. The report exhorts companies to invest urgently in IT upskilling strategies for incumbent workers, knowing that digital skills represent a key channel of productivity gains. How different might our society be if U.S. businesses had chosen to invest in people as well as in machines? Most companies opted for the smart machine over smart people, producing a well-documented pattern that favors substituting machines and their algorithms for human contributors in a wide range of jobs. By now, these include many occupations far from the factory floor. This results in what economists call job polarization, which features some high-skill jobs and other low-skill jobs, with automation displacing most of the jobs that were once in the middle. And although some business leaders, economists, and technologists describe these developments as necessary and inevitable consequences of computer-based technologies, research shows that the division of learning in the economic domain reflects the strength of the neoliberal ideology, politics, culture, and institutional patterns. For example, in continental and northern Europe, where key elements of the double movement have survived in some form, job polarization is moderated by substantial investments in workforce education that produce a more inclusive division of learning, as well as high-quality, innovative products and services. Most critical to our story is that we now face a second historical phase of this conflict. The division of learning in the economic domain of production and employment is critical, but it is only the beginning of a new struggle over the even larger question of the division of learning in society. The dilemmas of knowledge, authority, and power have burst through the walls of the workplace to overwhelm our daily lives. As people, processes, and things are reinvented as information, the division of learning in society becomes the ascendant principle of social ordering in our time. A wholly new electronic text now extends far beyond the confines of the factory or office. Thanks to our computers, credit cards and phones, and the cameras and sensors that proliferate in public and private spaces, just about everything we now do is mediated by computers that record and codify the details of our daily lives at a scale that would have been unimaginable only a few years ago. We have reached the point at which there is little that is omitted from the continuous accretion of this new electronic text. In later chapters, we review many illustrations of the new electronic text as it spreads silently but relentlessly like a colossal oil slick engulfing everything in its path. Your breakfast conversation, the streets in your neighborhood, the dimensions of your living room, your run in the park. The result is that both the world and our lives are pervasively rendered as information. Whether you are complaining about your acne or engaging in political debate on Facebook, searching for a recipe or sensitive health information on Google, ordering laundry soap or taking photos of your 9-year-old, smiling or thinking angry thoughts, watching TV or doing wheelies in the parking lot, All of it is raw material for this burgeoning text. Information scholar Martin Hilbert and his colleagues observe that even the foundational elements of civilization, including language, cultural assets, traditions, institutions, rules, and laws, are currently being digitized, and for the first time, explicitly put into visible code, then returned to society through the filter of intelligent algorithms deployed to govern a rapidly multiplying range of commercial, governmental, and social functions. The essential questions confront us at every turn. Who knows? Who decides? Who decides who decides? 3. Surveillance capital in the two texts. There are important parallels with the late 19th and early 20th centuries, when the division of labor first emerged as the foremost principle of social organization in the nascent industrial societies of Europe and North America. These experiences can offer guidance and alert us to what is at stake. For example, when the young Emile Durkheim wrote The Division of Labor in Society, the title itself was controversial. The division of labor had been understood as a critical means of achieving labor productivity through the specialization of tasks. Adam Smith memorably wrote about this new principle of industrial organization in his description of a pin factory, and the division of labor remained a topic of economic discourse and controversy throughout the 19th century. Durkheim recognized labor productivity as an economic imperative of industrial capitalism that would drive the division of labor to its most extreme application. But that was not what held his fascination. Instead, Durkheim trained his sights on the social transformation already gathering around him, observing that specialization was gaining influence in politics, administration, the judiciary, science, and the arts. He concluded that the division of labor was no longer quarantined in the industrial workplace. Instead, it had burst through those factory walls to becoming the critical organizing principle of industrial society. This is also an example of Edison's insight, that the principles of capitalism initially aimed at production eventually shape the wider social and moral milieu. "Whatever opinion one has about the division of labor," Durkheim wrote, "everyone knows that it exists and is more and more becoming one of the fundamental bases of the social order." Economic imperatives predictably mandated the division of labor in production. But what was the purpose of the division of labor in society? This was the question that motivated Durkheim's analysis, and his century-old conclusions are still relevant for us now. He argued that the division of labor accounts for the interdependencies and reciprocities that link the many diverse members of a modern industrial society in a larger prospect of solidarity. Reciprocities breed mutual need, engagement, and respect, all of which imbue this new ordering principle with moral force. In other words, the division of labor was summoned into society at the beginning of the 20th century by the rapidly changing circumstances of the first modernity's new individuals, discussed in Chapter 2. It was an essential response to their new conditions of existence. As people like my great-grandparents joined the migration to a modern world, the old sources of meaning that had bonded communities across space and time melted away. What would hold society together in the absence of the rules and rituals of clan and kin? Durkheim's answer was the division of labor. People's needs for a coherent new source of meaning and structure were the cause, and the effect was an ordering principle that enabled and sustained a healthy modern community. As the young sociologist explained, "The most remarkable effect of the division of labor is not that it increases output of functions divided, but that it renders them solidary. Its role is not simply to embellish or ameliorate existing societies, but to render societies possible which, without it, would not exist. It passes far beyond purely economic interests, for it consists in the establishment of a social and moral order sui generis." Durkheim's vision was neither sterile nor naive. He recognized that things can take a dark turn, and often do, resulting in what he called an abnormal, sometimes translated as pathological, division of labor that produces social distance, injustice, and discord in place of reciprocity and interdependency. In this context, Durkheim singled out the destructive effects of social inequality on the division of labor in society, especially what he viewed as the most dangerous form of inequality, extreme asymmetries of power that make conflict itself impossible by refusing to admit the right of combat. Such pathologies can be cured only by a politics that asserts the people's right to contest, confront, and prevail in the face of unequal and illegitimate power over society. In the late 19th century and most of the 20th century, that contest was led by labor and other social movements that asserted social equality through institutions such as collective bargaining and public education. The transformation that we witness in our time echoes these historical observations as the division of learning follows the same migratory path from the economic to the social domain once traveled by the division of labor. Now the division of learning passes far beyond purely economic interests, for it establishes the basis for our social order and its moral content. The division of learning is to us, members of the second modernity, what the division of labor was to our grandparents and great-grandparents, pioneers of the first modernity. In our time, the division of learning emerges from the economic sphere as a new principle of social order and reflects the primacy of learning, information, and knowledge in today's quest for effective life. And just as Durkheim warned his society a century ago, today, our societies are threatened as the division of learning drifts into pathology and injustice at the hands of the unprecedented asymmetries of knowledge and power that surveillance capitalism has achieved. Surveillance capitalism's command of the division of learning in society begins with what I call the problem of the two texts. The specific mechanisms of surveillance capitalism compel the production of two electronic texts, not just one. When it comes to the first text, we are its authors and readers. This public-facing text is familiar and celebrated for the universe of information and connection it brings to our fingertips. Google search codifies the informational content of the World Wide Web. Facebook's news feed binds the network. Much of this public-facing text is composed of what we inscribe on its pages. Our posts, blogs, videos, photos, conversations, music, stories, observations, likes, tweets, and all that great massing hubbub of our lives captured and communicated. Under the regime of surveillance capitalism, however, the first text does not stand alone. It trails a shadow close behind. The first text, full of promise, actually functions as a supply operation for the second text, the shadow text. Everything that we contribute to the first text, no matter how trivial or fleeting, becomes a target for surplus extraction. That surplus fills the pages of the second text. This one is hidden from our view. Read only for surveillance capitalists. In this text, our experience is dragooned as raw material to be accumulated and analyzed as means to others' market ends. The shadow text is a burgeoning accumulation of behavioral surplus and its analyses, and it says more about us than we can know about ourselves. Worse still, it becomes increasingly difficult and perhaps impossible to refrain from contributing to the shadow text. It automatically feeds on our experience as we engage in the normal and necessary routines of social participation. More mystifying still are the ways in which surveillance capitalists apply what they learn from their exclusive shadow text to shape the public text to their interests. There have been myriad revelations of Google and Facebook's manipulations of the information that we see. For now, I'll simply point out that Google's algorithms, derived from surplus, select and order search results, and Facebook's algorithms, derived from surplus, select and order the content of its news feed. In both cases, researchers have shown that these manipulations reflect each corporation's commercial objectives. As legal scholar Frank Pasquale describes it, the decisions at the Googleplex are made behind closed doors. The power to include, exclude, and rank is the power to ensure which public impressions become permanent and which remain fleeting. Despite their claims of objectivity and neutrality, they are constantly making value-laden, controversial decisions. They help create the world they claim to merely show us. When it comes to the shadow text, surveillance capitalism's laws of motion compel both its secrecy and its continuous growth. We are the objects of its narratives, from whose lessons we are excluded. As the source from which all the treasure flows, this second text is about us, but it is not for us. Instead, it is created, maintained, and exploited outside our awareness for others' benefit. The result is that the division of learning is both the ascendant principle of social ordering in our information civilization, and already a hostage to surveillance capitalism's privileged position as the dominant composer, owner, and guardian of the texts. Surveillance capitalism's ability to corrupt and control these texts produces unprecedented asymmetries of knowledge and power that operate precisely as Durkheim had feared. The relatively free rein accorded to this market form and the innately ineligible character of its action have enabled it to impose substantial control over the division of learning outside of our awareness and without means of combat. When it comes to the essential questions, surveillance capital has gathered the power and asserted the authority to supply all the answers. However, even authority is not enough. Only surveillance capital commands the material infrastructure and expert brain power to rule the division of learning in society. 4. The New Priesthood. Scientists warn that the world's capacity to produce information has substantially exceeded its ability to process and store information. Consider that our technological memory has roughly doubled about every 3 years. In 1986, only 1% of the world's information was digitized, and 25% in 2000. By 2013, the progress of digitalization and datafication, the application of software that allows computers and algorithms to process and analyze raw data, combined with new and cheaper storage technologies, had translated 98% of the world's information into a digital format. Information is digital, but its volume exceeds our ability to discern its meaning. As the solution to this problem, information scholar Martin Hilbert counsels, "The only option we have left to make sense of all the data is to fight fire with fire. Using artificially intelligent computers to sift through the vast amounts of information Facebook, Amazon, and Google have promised, to create value out of vast amounts of data through intelligent computational analysis." The rise of surveillance capitalism necessarily turns Hilbert's advice into a dangerous proposition. Although he does not mean to, Hilbert merely confirms the privileged position of the surveillance capitalists and the asymmetrical power that enables them to bend the division of learning to their interests. Google's asymmetrical power draws on all the social sources that we have considered, its declarations, its defensive fortifications, its exploitation of law, the legacy of surveillance exceptionalism, the burdens of second modernity individuals, and so on. But its power would not be operational without the gargantuan material infrastructure that surveillance revenues have bought. Google is the pioneer of hyperscale, considered to be the largest computer network on Earth. Hyperscale operations are found in high-volume information businesses, such as telecoms and global payments firms, where data centers require millions of virtual servers that exponentially increase computing capabilities without requiring substantial expansion of physical space, cooling, or electrical power demands. The machine intelligence at the heart of Google's formidable dominance is described as 80% infrastructure, a system that comprises custom-built, warehouse-sized data centers spanning 15 locations and, in 2016, an estimated 2.5 million servers in four continents. Investors deem Google harder to catch than ever because it is unmatched in its combination of infrastructure scale and science. Google is known as a full-stack AI company that uses its own data stores to train its own algorithms running on its own chips deployed on its own cloud. Its dominance is further strengthened by the fact that machine learning is only as intelligent as the amount of data it has to train on, and Google has the most data. By 2013, the company understood that its shift into the neural networks that define the current frontier of artificial intelligence would substantially increase computational demands and require a doubling of its data centers. As Urs Holtzle, Google's senior vice president of technical infrastructure, put it, "The dirty secret behind AI is that they require an insane number of computations to just actually train the network." If the company had tried to process the growing computational workload with traditional CPUs, he explained, "we would have had to double the entire footprint of Google, data centers and servers, just to do 3 minutes or 2 minutes of speech recognition per Android user per day." With data center construction as the company's largest line item and power as its highest operating cost, Google invented its way through the infrastructure crisis. In 2016, it announced the development of a new chip for deep learning inference called the Tensor Processing Unit, TPU. The TPU would dramatically expand Google's machine intelligence capabilities, consume only a fraction of the power required by existing processors, and reduce both capital expenditure and the operational budget, all while learning more and faster. Global revenue for AI products and services is expected to increase 56-fold, from $644 million in 2016 to $36 billion in 2025. The science required to exploit this vast opportunity and the material infrastructure that makes it possible have ignited an arms race among tech companies for the 10,000 or so professionals on the planet who know how to wield the technologies of machine intelligence to coax knowledge from an otherwise cacophonous data continent. Google Alphabet is the most aggressive acquirer of AI technology and talent. In 2014 to 2016, it purchased 9 AI companies, twice as many as its nearest rival, Apple. The concentration of AI talent at Google reflects a larger trend. In 2017, U.S. companies are estimated to have allocated more than $650 million to fuel the AI talent race, with more than 10,000 available positions at top employers across the country. The top 5 tech companies have the capital to crowd out competitors. Startups, universities, municipalities, established corporations in other industries, and less wealthy countries. In Britain, university administrators are already talking about a missing generation of data scientists. The huge salaries of the tech firms have lured so many professionals that there is no one left to teach the next generation of students. As one scholar described it, "The real problem is these people are not dispersed through society. The intellect and expertise is concentrated in a small number of companies." On the strength of its lavish recruitment efforts, Google tripled its number of machine intelligence scientists in just the last few years and has become the top contributor to the most prestigious scientific journals, 4 to 5 times the world average in 2016. Under the regime of surveillance capitalism, the corporation's scientists are not recruited to solve world hunger or eliminate carbon-based fuels. Instead, their genius is meant to storm the gates of human experience, transforming it into data and translating it into a new market colossus that creates wealth by predicting, influencing, and controlling human behavior. More than 600 years ago, the printing press put the written word into the hands of ordinary people, rescuing the prayers, bypassing the priesthood, and delivering the opportunity for spiritual communion directly into the hands of the prayerful. We have come to take for granted that the Internet enables an unparalleled diffusion of information, promising more knowledge for more people, a mighty democratizing force that exponentially realizes Gutenberg's revolution in the lives of billions of individuals. But this grand achievement has blinded us to a different historical development, one that moves out of range and out of sight, designed to exclude, confuse, and obscure. In this hidden movement, the competitive struggle over surveillance revenues reverts to the pre-Gutenberg order, as the division of learning in society shades toward the pathological, captured by a narrow priesthood of privately employed computational specialists, their privately owned machines, and the economic interests for whose sake they learn. 5. The privatization of the division of learning in society. The division of learning in society has been hijacked by surveillance capitalism. In the absence of a robust double movement in which democratic institutions and civil society tether raw information capitalism to the people's interests, however imperfectly, we are thrown back on the market form of the surveillance capitalist companies in this most decisive of contests over the division of learning in society. Experts in the disciplines associated with machine intelligence know this, but they have little grasp of its wider implications. As data scientist Pedro Domingos writes, "Whoever has the best algorithms and the most data wins. Google, with its head start and larger market share, knows better what you want. Whoever learns fastest wins." The New York Times reports that Google CEO Sundar Pichai now shares a floor with the company's AI research lab and notes it as a trend among many CEOs, a literal take on the concentration of power. Just over 30 years ago, legal scholar Spiros Simitis published a seminal essay on the theme of privacy in an information society. Simitis grasped early on that the already visible trends in public and private information processing harbored threats to society that transcended narrow conceptions of privacy and data ownership. Personal information is increasingly used to enforce standards of behavior. Information processing is developing, therefore, into an essential element of long-term strategies of manipulation intended to mold and adjust individual conduct. Simitis argued that these trends were incompatible not only with privacy, but with the very possibility of democracy, which depends upon a reservoir of individual capabilities associated with autonomous moral judgment and self-determination. Building on Samiti's work, Berkeley's Paul M. Schwartz warned in 1989 that computerization would transform the delicate balance of rights and obligations upon which privacy law depends. Today, the enormous amounts of personal data available in computers threaten the individual in a way that renders obsolete much of the previous legal protection. Most important, Schwartz foresaw that the scale of the still-emerging crisis would impose risks that exceed the scope of privacy law. The danger that the computer poses is to human autonomy. The more that is known about a person, the easier it is to control him. Ensuring the liberty that nourishes democracy requires a structuring of societal use of information and even permitting some concealment of information. Both Simitis and Schwartz sensed the ascent of the division of learning as the axial principle of a new computational societal milieu, but they could not have anticipated the rise of surveillance capitalism and its consequences. Although the explosive growth of the information continent shifts a crucial axis at the social order from a 20th century division of labor to a 21st century division of learning, it is surveillance capitalists who command the field and unilaterally lay claim to a disproportionate share of the decision rights that shape the division of learning in society. Surveillance capitalists' acts of digital dispossession impose a new kind of control upon individuals, populations, and whole societies. Individual privacy is a casualty of this control, and its defense requires a reframing of privacy discourse, law, and judicial reasoning. The invasion of privacy is now a predictable dimension of social inequality, but it does not stand alone. It is the systematic result of a pathological division of learning in society, in which surveillance capitalism knows, decides, and decides who decides. Demanding privacy from surveillance capitalists or lobbying for an end to commercial surveillance on the internet is like asking Henry Ford to make each Model T by hand, or asking a giraffe to shorten its neck. Such demands are existential threats. They violate the basic mechanisms and laws of motion that produce this market leviathan's concentrations of knowledge, power, and wealth. So here is what is at stake. Surveillance capitalism is profoundly anti-democratic. But its remarkable power does not originate in the state, as has historically been the case. Its effects cannot be reduced to or explained by technology or the bad intentions of bad people. They are the consistent and predictable consequences of an internally consistent and successful logic of accumulation. Surveillance capitalism rose to dominance in the U.S. under conditions of relative lawlessness. From there, it spread to Europe, and it continues to make inroads in every region of the world. Surveillance capitalist firms, beginning with Google, dominate the accumulation and processing of information, especially information about human behavior. They know a great deal about us, but our access to their knowledge is sparse, hidden in the shadow text and read only by the new priests, their bosses, and their machines. This unprecedented concentration of knowledge produces an equally unprecedented concentration of power, asymmetries that must be understood as the unauthorized privatization of the division of learning in society. This means that powerful private interests are in control of the definitive principle of social ordering in our time, just as Durkheim warned of the subversion of the division of labor by the powerful forces of industrial capital a century ago. As things currently stand, it is the surveillance capitalist corporations that know. It is the market form that decides. It is the competitive struggle among surveillance capitalists that decides who decides. 6. The Power of the Unprecedented. A Review. The titanic power struggles of the 20th century were between industrial capital and labor. But the 21st century finds surveillance capital pitted against the entirety of our societies, right down to each individual member. The competition for surveillance revenues bears down on our bodies, our homes, and our cities in a battle for power and profit as violent as any the world has seen. Surveillance capitalism cannot be imagined as something out there in factories and offices. Its aims and effects are here, are us. Ours is not simply a case of being ambushed and outgunned. We were caught off guard because there was no way that we could have imagined these acts of invasion and dispossession, any more than the first unsuspecting Taino cacique could have foreseen the rivers of blood that would flow from his inaugural gesture of hospitality toward the hairy, grunting, sweating men, the adelantados, who appeared out of thin air, waving the banner of the Spanish monarchs and their pope as they trudged across the beach. Why have we been slow to recognize the original sin of simple robbery at the heart of this new capitalism? Like the Tainos, we faced something altogether new to our story, the unprecedented. And like them, we risk catastrophe when we assess new threats through the lens of old experience. On the supply side, surveillance capitalists deftly employed the entire arsenal of the Declaration to assert their authority and legitimacy in a new and undefended digital world. They used declarations to take without asking. They camouflaged their purpose with illegible machine operations, moved at extreme velocities, sheltered secretive corporate practices, mastered rhetorical misdirection, taught helplessness, purposefully misappropriated cultural signs and symbols associated with the themes of the second modernity, empowerment, participation, voice, individualization, collaboration, and baldly appealed to the frustrations of second modernity individuals thwarted in the collision between psychological yearning and institutional indifference. In this process, the pioneer surveillance capitalists at Google and Facebook evaded the disciplines of corporate governance and rejected the disciplines of democracy, protecting their claims with financial influence and political relationships. Finally, they benefited from history, born in a time when regulation was equated with tyranny and the state of exception precipitated by the terrorist attacks of 9/11 produced surveillance exceptionalism, further enabling the new market to root and flourish. Surveillance capitalists' purposeful strategies and accidental gifts produced a form that can romance and beguile, but is also ruthlessly efficient at extinguishing space for democratic deliberation, social debate, individual self-determination, and the right to combat as it forecloses every path to exit. On the demand side, second modernity populations starved for enabling resources were so enraptured by the plentiful bags of rice and powdered milk thrown from the back of the digital truck that little attention was paid to the drivers or their destination. We needed them. We even believed that we couldn't live without them. But under scrutiny, those long-awaited delivery trucks look more like automated vehicles of invasion and conquest. More Mad Max than Red Cross, more Black Sails than Carnival Cruise. The wizards behind their steering wheels careen across every hill and hollow, learning how to scrape and stockpile our behavior, over which they unabashedly assert their rights as conquerors' plunder. In the absence of a clear-minded appreciation of this new logic of accumulation, every attempt at understanding, predicting, regulating, or prohibiting the activities of surveillance capitalists will fall short. The primary frameworks through which our societies have sought to assert control over surveillance capitalism's audacity are those of privacy rights and monopoly. Neither the pursuit of privacy regulations nor the imposition of constraints on traditional monopoly practices has so far interrupted the key mechanisms of accumulation, from supply routes to behavioral futures markets. On the contrary, surveillance capitalists have extended and elaborated their extraction architectures across every human domain as they master the practical and political requirements of the dispossession cycle. This success now threatens the deepest principles of social order in an information civilization, as surveillance capitalism takes unauthorized command over the division of learning in society. If there is to be a fight, let it be a fight over capitalism. Let it be an insistence that raw surveillance capitalism is as much a threat to society as it is to capitalism itself. This is not a technical undertaking, not a program for advanced encryption, improved data anonymity, or data ownership. Such strategies only acknowledge the inevitability of commercial surveillance. They leave us hiding in our own lives as we cede control to those who feast on our behavior for their own purposes. Surveillance capitalism depends on the social. And it is only in and through collective social action that the larger promise of an information capitalism aligned with a flourishing third modernity can be reclaimed. In part one, we have seen how Google built its extraction architecture in the online world. As competition for surveillance revenues intensified, a second economic imperative rose to prominence, driving an expansion of that architecture into another world, the one that we call real. Now the story of surveillance capitalism moves in this new direction. In part two, I invite you to rekindle your sense of astonishment as we follow the trail of this second economic imperative defined by the prediction of human behavior. The prediction imperative enlarges the complexity of surplus operations as economies of scale are joined by economies of scope and economies of action. These new disciplines drive surveillance capitalism far into the intimate reaches of our daily lives and deep into our personalities and our emotions. Ultimately, they compel the development of highly inventive but resolutely secret new means to interrupt and modify our behavior for the sake of surveillance revenues. These operations challenge our elemental right to the future tense, which is the right to act free of the influence of illegitimate forces that operate outside our awareness to influence, modify, and condition our behavior. We grow numb to these incursions and the ways in which they deform our lives. We succumb to the drumbeat of inevitability, but nothing here is inevitable. Astonishment is lost, but can be found again.